Well, it's really a pleasure having you here.
Oh, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I read the short stories a few years ago when they came out. Yeah. They were wonderful short stories.
Thank you.
Equal Affections.
Yeah.
I read, I think, in close to one sitting. It might have been two.
Oh, well, that's great. I'm glad to know you read it that way. I like novels like that, too, and I try to write them. Novels that kind of, I mean, in a sense, it seems to me a novel ought to be a little bit like a giant short story. You know, it should be something that you want to absorb in one breath. Or it should at least structurally feel that way, even if you don't necessarily read it that way. Although, of course, there are other novels that are very long and that you can sort of live with day after day after day. I was in Europe just for 3 months this fall, and I decided I only wanted to bring one book with me because I wanted to pack as lightly as I could. I was
doing
a lot of traveling. One big book. So I brought the collected E.F. Benson, Map and Lucia novels. Have you read those?
No, I don't know those.
They were on PBS. They were adapted on PBS. They were written in the 20s. Very kind of Wodehousian comedies of manners about all these very foppish people living in a funny little village in Sussex in the 1920s. And they were televised, they were dramatized by the BBC, and they were on PBS a couple years ago. Very, very funny. And they were perfect books for trains because you could just sort of pick them up and it was six novels in one volume. You just sort of pick it up and read and be very happily absorbed and then stop, maybe not read it for another 4 days, and then pick it up and continue. So that's not what this sort of book. This is not that sort of book, but
no,
there's room in life for both.
I made the mistake in years past of traveling with the new fall books. In the summer, when I would go on vacation, take the new fall books that would come out, and they're all hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know how heavy these books are when you have them in a flight bag and you're traveling on an airplane. You've got your suitcase and something else to carry as well. So I began to realize that traveling with hardcover books is pretty hard, so I've gone back to paperbacks.
Traveling with books, period, is hard. I mean, it's the only time in my life that I ever wish I was a non-reader is when I go on trips, because invariably, even if I go away for 3 days, I find myself psychologically compelled to pack about six books, just in case I don't like the first one, so I'll have some backups, because the thought of being stuck someplace with nothing to read is terrifying to me.
Yes, me too.
And the problem with that, of course, is just the lugging that you have to do.
Can you sleep at night without reading before you go to bed?
It depends how tired I am. But I usually like to read something. Even if I'm really tired, what I've been doing lately is looking at cartoon books. This has been like Linda Barry, who's this, or Roz Chast books. These have become when I'm too exhausted to actually absorb any prose, this has become the substitute. But usually I always read before I go to bed.
Well, I can't sleep. Even if I'm too tired to actually read, I'll still open up the book.
Yeah.
And my eyes will scan a few paragraphs, and then I'll close the book.
Oh, you found the right profession.
Yeah. Well, but back to you.
Yes.
In Equal Affections, you make it seem so easy in terms of the writing. But I know from dabbling with this in an amateurish way, it's hard. But that is that shows the skill of a good writer, isn't it? And somebody can pick up a book and read it quickly. The book may take years to write,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's written so well, so smoothly, that the reader might say, well, hell, he did a nice job. I guess he wrote this last weekend. So tell me a little bit about your approach to writing and how you have made it seem so easy.
Well, it requires a lot of hammering in the sense that, this book took me about 3 years to write, and it was very hard going and very slow going. And indeed, I do want that illusion of ease. I like it when a book seems to have just sort of flowed out of the author's mind complete. Of course, I don't think that ever happens, or almost never happens. In my case, the process of writing is very, very slow. I write on a computer, which, in a sense, is perfect for me, because I do an endless amount of revision. I do so much revision that the term draft sort of ceases to have any meaning. You know, I know writers who say, oh, I'm doing the third draft of my novel or the fourth draft, but for me it's sort of a constant process of redrafting even as I go along. And so usually when I'm working on a novel, which is a a life-consuming process. When I sit down to write, what I'll do is I'll go over probably the last 20 pages that I've written and the process, ceaselessly revise them and then go on from there. And I always follow the advice, which I've heard alternately attributed to Faulkner and Hemingway, of stopping when you don't want to stop, stopping when things are really going well so that you'll have something to go back to the next day. Because if you give in to the urge to sort of follow a good spell of writing out to its natural conclusion and you end a chapter or something, then you're going to want the next day to just sort of bask in the pleasure of having finished it. And the day after, it's going to be that much harder to go back to work. So I always try to stop when I really don't want to stop. And that means that the next morning I'll rush off to my computer to get working again. So this sort of revision goes on endlessly, and it's really almost arbitrary for me deciding when it's finished. I mean, I guess it becomes a little bit like Zeno's paradox, where you have the revisions get more and more tiny and tinier and tinier and tinier, but you really could go on forever, even if it means each draft you change one word or one punctuation point.
But if you revise the way you describe, what happens if you make a revision?
Mm-hmm.
And you go back to it later and decided, well, I'm not happy with that revision. I like the way it was before, but you've discarded it because it was on the computer.
I keep a hard copy of everything for just that purpose. I'm extremely paranoid about the dangers of writing with a computer, whether it's losing original versions of things or whether it's a disk being accidentally erased, and I take a lot of precautions. So every day I'll do a hard copy of what I finished that day, which means that I acquire enormous piles of paper in the process of writing. But that way, at least, I know that I have it, and in case the next day, after I've done the revisions, I want to go back to something that I've gotten rid of, I'll have a hard copy of it. I also keep multiple copies of every disc in all sorts of places, in the refrigerator.
I have a feeling you use a Macintosh.
I have a Macintosh. How did you guess?
Well, because you make reference to, the father in Equal Affections, is an old-line computer expert who's been left behind and never heard of Stephen Jobs and didn't really understand what a PC is. I think there may have been another reference to a Macintosh here and there.
There might be. The Macintosh certainly, my impression is that the Macintosh has become the computer of choice among writers that I know, I guess because it's so, quote-unquote, user-friendly. At one point, I was trying to work on an Olivetti computer this fall when I was in Europe, and it just seems so difficult compared to the Macintosh. I couldn't imagine how anyone could write on anything else. And with PCs, there's so much to memorize.
Well, let's go back. Let's talk about the family in Equal Affections. Of course, it opens with the parent dying of the hero's mother. This takes place predominantly in California. I have some suspicion that the family life in Equal Affections parallels your own life a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about the story and the family in this book?
It does. There are. I'd be lying if I said there weren't parallels to my own family's life. Although I tend to downplay that because I don't want this book to be sort of summed up easily as an autobiographical novel, because it's not. It's a real mix of stuff from my own life and things that I invented and things that I changed and altered and drew in from other experiences or other people that I know or other people's stories. But to my mind, this is a family which is, one thing I wanted to do was to create a kind of family, a 1980s family, a family which in a lot of ways is rather bizarre. Certainly doesn't fit the sort of George Bush gentler, kinder nation paradigm of the family by any stretch of the imagination. And yet to write about them in a way which was not satirical and not parodic and not kind of a la Sarah McFadden in The Serial, this sort of far out California family played out up for all its weirdness, but to write about them in a way that would make them seem very ordinary. That would make them seem as ordinary as they actually are. To try to strike a balance between the unorthodox nature of most of the people's, of the life of this family and the fact that even the most unorthodox lives to the people who are living them seem ordinary. And I wanted to constantly have that tension between the sense of strangeness and the sense of ordinariness playing in the book, as well as a sense of a paradoxical sense of tension of between the extent to which the story of this family is complete. Excuse me.
Can I get you some water?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. I've got a dust mote in my throat or something. Shall I backtrack a little bit or just start where I was again?
Where were we?
I was saying a paradoxical tension. I hope I wasn't being too incoherent. Between the way in which this family is extremely unique and the way in which, in a sense, that it's everyone's family. It seems to me that's one of the wonderful things that fiction can do, is to give you the feeling at the same moment that what you're reading is a completely unique and strange and wonderful story about people you've never encountered, and at the same time the sense that you're reading your own story, the sense that the story feels so immediate and so intimate and so familiar that it could be your family, it could be you. There was a Gordon Lish, who was a teacher of mine years ago, edited a book of an anthology of short fiction which was called All Our Secrets Are the Same. And I think some of that tension, I mean that title implies some of the tension that I'm talking about, the fact that at the same moment, of course, each of our lives, each of our experiences, each of our secrets is individual, but there's a certain universal factor. There's something that makes them all, in a sense, the same. And I wanted to show with this family both how it was a very unique, very peculiar family, and also how it was, in a sense, the most ordinary family in the world.
Well, you can say that now, but I doubt that you said that to yourself before you began writing. Don't you begin?
Of course not.
No, you begin with characters and an idea, and it's easy. It's easier to analyze what you've done after you've done it than to try to analyze what you are about to do, isn't that?
Sure. And as you go further, as you grow further away from a book, it gets easier and easier to analyze it because you get more perspective. When I started writing this book, all I had in mind initially was a character, April, the sister. And a relationship between a brother and sister. That was all I was starting with. And the very beginnings of the book were simply an account of the relationship between this very powerful, very charismatic, very egotistical woman and her brother, who has basically devoted a certain portion of his life to taking care of her. And as I began to write it, it became clear that this relationship wasn't going to last, and I started moving out beyond the period when they were traveling around the country together into their lives maybe 10 years later, and then the parents came in. And slowly the book started accreting around the notion of this family as the various dynamics of the family came together. It was the sort of book where it took me a long time before I actually was able to even say to anyone what it was about, because it was so much forming out of the elements of the story. I had no sense of a theme or a goal of the kind that I was just talking about, and that I didn't realize, in fact, until after I'd finished it. I would tend to distrust a writer who begins a novel by saying, I'm going to write a novel about the interplay between psychology and politics or something. Yeah, I think that novels really begin...
Well, I want to show the struggle between good and evil.
Yes, exactly.
So, novels, how do I begin?
They begin with people. At least for me, they always begin with people.
Yeah. Now, in Equal Affections, April and her brother... Sorry, I forgot.
Danny.
Now, they're both gay.
Mm.
And
well, April is questionable.
Questionable, right.
Danny's gay.
She at least asserts her gayness.
Yeah.
Although she does reveal toward the end that she had had some affairs, mm-hmm. I think for 10 or 12 years or so, she maintained that she was a lesbian,
yeah.
But that wasn't completely accurate,
mm-hmm.
I guess. But the lifestyles of April and Danny seem to be taken so casually, even by the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the way it is?
Well, I think it's the way it is for some people, certainly the way it is for them. There are two ways to answer that question. One is to sort of attempt something sociological. Sure, there are families like this that happily accept the homosexuality of their children. There are other families that don't. In this case, I think one of the reasons why Nat and Louise, the parents, have been able to come to terms as easily as they have with the homosexuality of their children is because other things have occurred in their lives which put the homosexuality of their children in perspective and have made them realize that compared to some of the other things that can happen to you, having gay children isn't a tragedy. Louise has spent much of her life being ill, having cancer, in and out of hospitals with this constant consciousness of death, of her own death, kind of hovering over her. I think that for her, that constant knowledge of mortality has made her realize what's what, has made her realize that having gay children is by no means a tragedy, since she knows, in a sense, what real tragedy is. And I don't mean to say that that's particularly heroic or noble of her. It's simply the way she's come to that conclusion. On another level, as it is important to me as a writer, one thing that I'm very determined to do is to write about gay characters in the context of family life and not simply in the context of the quote-unquote gay world. To show the ways in which their homosexuality does and doesn't matter. Of course, in certain ways it's crucial, and in other ways it's irrelevant. And that in this book, that again point has to do with something I was saying earlier. There's a gay couple in the book. In a sense, the fact that they're two men makes them unique, makes them different from a straight couple. But in many other ways, they're exactly like any straight couple.
Right.
And I wanted to show both those things at the same time, both what makes them unique and what makes them hard to distinguish from anyone else.
That's right. Danny and
Walter.
Walter, both are lawyers. They tend to live a very ordinary life in, mm-hmm. in New Jersey. And mm-hmm. Of course, Walter has a kind of a secret life, and that he is sexually obsessed and uses his computer to meet others like
yes, this
that.
Is a very late 80s form of promiscuity.
The CompuServe enables this, does it?
Among other, it's become a big thing, and it's not just a gay thing at all. I think that we live in an age in which intimacy has become a very scary thing, both not only because of the fear of AIDS, but also because it seems to me it's a direction that America has been going in for a long time. Something that Susan Sontag said in her book AIDS and Its Metaphors, which I thought was quite brilliant, was that after two decades of sexual spending and sexual inflation, we are entering a sexual depression. And now in the midst of a sexual depression where people are quite timid about real intimacy, these odd substitutes are cropping up, everything from these phone lines that you can call up and talk to people to what seems to me the most anti-intimate form of sexual interchange imaginable, which is sex through a computer.
Who has time? I mean, when I first signed on to CompuServe, I spent all night playing with it and then getting horrendous telephone bills. And I don't even bother
with it. Oh, yes. And you hadn't even discovered the CB simulator.
CompuServe has gotten so big that I can't even figure it out.
Well, if you're ever curious about it, just press go CB. And you'll find yourself entering an extremely bizarre world with many different channels, and each channel has a theme. There's a so-called adult channel, there's the gay channel, there's a teen channel, there's a Jewish channel, there's a transvestite channel. Now that seems to me pretty wild, the idea of being a drag queen through a computer, since this, I always thought the whole idea of being a drag queen was how you looked. But I guess it's an opportunity for sort of psychic drag queens to kind of go in drag without actually having to put on women's clothes. It's pretty wild.
Are gay themes going to be persistent in your work?
Who knows? It's not something that I can really predict. I certainly think that gay characters are going to keep cropping up in my work, but I'm not sure if I would say gay themes necessarily are. At the moment, I sort of have my finger in a lot of different pots. I'm doing a lot of different kinds of writing right now. And some of it, I would say, has more of a gay theme than others.
But you obviously would be more comfortable writing from your own gay perspective than, say, were you to write about a West Virginia coal miner and, you know, the with the hillbilly draw, people that you have no relationship
with. Well, I don't know if I could write about a West Virginia coal miner, but certainly write about, I certainly feel no lack of confidence about writing from the point of view of straight people. And I've done that a lot, and I would continue to do that. I think that generally, gay writers have done an admirable job throughout history of writing convincingly from the point of view of straight people. I'm not sure that it goes the other direction.
You may be right. Edmund White is a brilliant writer. I don't know if you
know. Oh, yeah, sure.
And not only, well, he'll write anything.
Sure, of course.
He can write fairy tales, or he can write persuasively about gays or not.
Yeah.
And he's got, and he has an audience that is universal.
I'm doing a lot of, I mean, I'm completing a book of short stories right now. I would say about a third to half of them having to do fairly explicitly with gay issues. The others, not at all. But I don't want to be hemmed in by that. I don't think any writer, I don't think it's a good idea to ever allow yourself to become too identified, either in your own mind or in the mind of other people, with a particular subject. And in general, I think writers are rather uncomfortable at having adjectives in front of the word writer when it comes to them, especially if those adjectives are things like gay, Jewish, young, woman. You know, I don't think any writer, most women writers don't like being called a woman writer. Most Jewish writers don't like being called a Jewish writer. I have to sort of juggle three adjectives all the time, which are gay, well, two mostly, gay and young. And one of them I'm able to grow out of. The other one I'm not. So,
tell me a little bit about life as you grew up. Your father, of course, was, or presumably still is, mm-hmm. An academic, so
yeah.
You must have had a very literate household.
I did. I grew up in a very sort of enlightened and in some ways rather peculiar environment. My father has taught for many years at Stanford Business School. And I grew up on the Stanford campus. I had an older brother and sister who were both undergraduates at Stanford when I was in elementary school. And so I used to go down to their dorms. This was about 1970, 1971, where, you know, all their friends would kind of offer me marijuana. And I had a guitar, and I used to sing songs. I was a little hippie child. It was an and I always grew up with lots of books, lots of a very intellectually enriched background. Ironically, the real source of my love of writing and of literature came from my mother, who was probably the only kind of, in a technical sense, non-educated person in my family. I mean, everyone in my family has multiple degrees, with the exception of me. I have a BA, but I never got any graduate degrees. And my mother, who never finished college. And it was my mother who was the reader. My mother, who I think had the spirit of a writer. My mother, who all through her life talked about writing a novel and never did. And it was ironically, I think, she was always an avid reader of fiction. And it was really ironically, I think, through her and not through my hyper-educated siblings or my father, the professor, that I developed a real love of literature.
You went on to Yale. What did
mm-hmm.
you study there?
I was an English major. I focused
That's
mostly...
no surprise, I guess.
No surprise at all. There was very little that was surprising about my education. The only thing that... It's potentially surprising was that the focus of my sort of academic life wasn't contemporary fiction. It was Renaissance poetry. I wrote a senior essay about the fairy queen, Spenser. And I think sometimes people are surprised by that because they figure that I would have been, you know, writing it about John Cheever or something. But in fact, I was very much absorbed in Renaissance literature, which I still think has a lot more to do with what we're doing now than most people would probably believe.
Well, what in the world did you plan to do with this degree in English when you graduated?
Well, I had always had two separate goals. One was that I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to write fiction. I was writing fiction all the time, but I never imagined that I could make a career out of it. I was, until a year before I graduated, when I published my first story in The New Yorker, and that proved to be a very helpful break in terms of my career, I was fully intending to go on to graduate school in English. And continue doing Renaissance literature. Probably I would have stayed at Yale.
And taught.
If I was lucky enough to get a job. I'm sure you know the situation for academics right now is pretty grim.
Why?
Well, at least at that point, there just weren't enough jobs for all the people getting PhDs. So we were being always very strongly discouraged, those of us who expressed interest in going to graduate school in English, from doing it. being told, you know, it's a terrible mistake. You won't be able to get a job. You'll spend 5 years of your life, and at the end, you'll be bitter and angry and have to go to law school.
I know the pay scales are dreadfully low in the
IT world. But at that point, you know, I was right in the thick of it. It seemed very exciting to me. And also, I knew that I had limited capacities, and I knew that there were not many parts of the world that I was going to be able to function in profitably. I knew it, for instance, that I could never be a sort of traditional working person. I didn't have the right kind of mind for that. I knew I couldn't be a lawyer, which is what I think all my parents' friends always hoped or imagined I would be, since that's always sort of the catch-all profession for sort of intelligent, artistically minded people. And I figured there were the alternatives for me, basically, were either be a writer, if I could succeed, if I could make a living at that, be an academic and teach and also write, or work in publishing. None of these, you know, are necessarily very profitable endeavors, but it never seemed to me I had much choice. And I was lucky because the one that I wanted the most and the one that I cared the most fiercely about, the kind of career I wanted the most, I was actually able to have pretty much from the beginning, which was enormous, enormous good luck. And a turn of luck that I continue to be endlessly grateful for.
Well, you say luck. I assume that there is a degree of luck, but at the same time, you've shown terrific skill. Those of us who are in our dotage and dabble at it marvel at the ability of someone so young to write so well. I think you've done a terrific job. I thought Equal Affection was a wonderful, wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
David, I thank you very, very much for talking to me.
Well, thanks for having me.